caters to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 12th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, and ideas at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Matea Carlin, Ed Travaglia, Reed Johnson, and Ezra. The producer and engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Danielle Smith, Catherine Carley, Jill Freitas, Eric Galatis, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is the effervescent Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. As Oregon legislators debate the effects of Measure 110 and whether to recriminalize drugs, we're taking a look at the other half of the landmark measure, the influx in funding for substance use disorder treatment and recovery services. It's meant to help build a continuum of care for people, and it represents a historic investment in a long-neglected field in Oregon. Shannon Jones Isidore is the CEO and founder of the Oregon Change Clinic, a recipient of those funds. Their treatment and temporary housing services are specifically aimed at serving BIPOC Portlanders. I spoke with Shannon to learn more. Well, welcome. Thank you for being here. Can you tell me a little bit about Oregon Change Clinic?
Absolutely. We are an outpatient treatment facility, and we do treatment for those that are working through substance use disorder and mental health issues, so mild to moderate mental health challenges. Our target population, those that we work primarily with, are Black, Indigenous people of color. The majority of our clients, Althea, I would say, are African-American men.
And how did Oregon Change Clinic get started?
I have a background in psychotherapy, so my degrees and credentials are all in psychology and therapy, and so I started working in the field of psychology and treatment facilities and that. And so I'm also, I didn't mention it earlier, I'm also a United States Marine Corps veteran. And so I had gone to the Marines and then also college. So I got to a point out there where I was working in the field of psychology. And I started making money and wasn't sure exactly what to do with the money. How to invest the money. So I'd heard of 401ks and IRAs and that. And so I go to a seminar on how money works. And I end up at the seminar, I meet a Marine who's the vice chairman of the company. And he says, you know, I can show you how to get in the investment world. And at the time, I said, no, I'm a psychologist. That's not what I do. And he says, well, you can use all of your psychology skills to help people with saving and investing money. After a few months of speaking with me about that, I end up changing fields and go into the investment field. I open an investment firm, and I'm traveling from California to Portland back and forth because this is my hometown. I'm a native of Portland, Oregon, and my grandmother ends up needing more care here. So I make the decision to move back to Portland. I thought, Althea, that I was going to open a financial firm here in Portland and still have the one in California, but it wasn't going in that direction. But organizations that would find out about my background in psychology, a lot of the large organizations here, would jump at the chance to hire me or bring me on as a consultant. So I started working as a consultant and a director at various organizations in behavioral health. That's when I realized that there was a real need for a culturally specific treatment facility. So in 2021, I opened Organ Change Clinic as a culturally specific outpatient treatment facility here in Portland, Oregon.
Wow, that's what a tale.
Oh, I didn't mean to take you all around.
No.
Thank you.
Can you tell me some of the things that in being like a consultant and starting to get involved in the field of behavioral health, was there a particular moment that made you realize that there was a need for culturally specific services, or was it a pattern of things that you were seeing?
It was definitely a pattern of things that I was seeing. One, that there were small amounts of people of color, African Americans particularly, that were in treatment. And their success rates were low. So the number of people completing treatment. And then I would see how they were constantly being discharged. So there were conversations in several meetings about this, like, why are people of color discharged more frequently than people who are not people of color? Part of it had to do with expectations, had to do with trainings, misunderstandings. So there were various reasons. And a lot of the organizations and myself, as a director of those organizations or a consultant, we would work through them, or at least try to work on them. There was also a small amount of number of clinicians, so counselors, therapists, as well as people in high leadership positions, directors and executives.
Can you tell me, so you mentioned the outpatient treatment, and there's, in your website, you kind of describe the sort of three component pieces of what Organ Change Clinic does, substance use disorder and mental health treatment, TMS treatment for depression and temporary housing. Can we address each of those and you tell me a little bit about what they are and maybe how they fit together?
Absolutely. I will say that when we opened Organ Change Clinic, it didn't look the way that it looks now. Yeah. So opened Organ Change Clinic thinking that we would be a culturally specific outpatient clinic right here in Northeast Portland. And we were helping people who had substance use disorder challenges as well as mental health challenges. And we thought we'd be open Monday through Friday. And pretty much that was what we thought that the clinic would look like. And we would do treatment, like people would be in our treatment for about 90 days. Yes, it was 90 days at the time. What we quickly realized is that people needed housing. And so when people would come to our clinic for treatment and they did not have housing and needed housing, they were experiencing houselessness, their treatment was inconsistent. It was sporadic. They would sometimes sleep at our front door just to make sure that they were there when we opened. So we started housing people in affordable motels, cheap motels around town. Some people were in Beaverton, some people were on Interstate, some people were at the Sixth Avenue Motel. So we were doing our very best because it wasn't in our original business model. And so that's when I knew that we needed to add this housing component. So we go to one of the motels that we were housing people and we asked, how could we just take over the entire motel? I mean, it was a big vision at the time. And like I said, it wasn't in our original business plan, but we knew that was going to be the way to really help people. So after much negotiations, we end up taking over the entire Sixth Avenue Motel. I also needed to control the environment because I was housing people at all these places around town and I couldn't control the environment. And they're in the room next door to someone who's renting the room by the hour. And so I wanted to see how we can give people the best opportunity for success. So in taking over the entire motel, we weren't sure exactly because it needed renovation. It needed quite a bit of support. So we decided to do that anyway, even though we didn't have the funding or money to make it all happen. We just knew it was going to be important in helping people through their recovery journey.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another thing that you had mentioned was also some of the other treatments that we have. So TMS treatment stands for transcranial magnetic stimulation. And Althea, that is a treatment for those who are experiencing major depressive disorder or chronic depression. And so what we realized is that oftentimes clients who are coming for substance use disorder treatment are also experiencing mental health issues and challenges. So we wanted to see how we could do our very best to help people with as many issues as we could, you know. And mental health was we were seeing over and over again, was going hand in hand, side by side with those who were experiencing substance use disorder.
Mm-hmm. Well, Organ Change Clinic received funding from Measure 110 through the Behavioral Health Resource Network Allocation, or BERN, funding. Yes. Can you tell me a little bit about the process of getting those funds to Organ Change Clinic and what it's allowed you to do?
Yes, the process in receiving the funds was quite extensive. I mean, it took, although the measure had passed some time ago, we had ended up receiving the funds a year later. But however, when we received the funds, quite grateful, what we were able to do and still able to do with the funds is it helped with the housing. So if I go back to that part of the story and the Sixth Avenue Motel, we knew that we were going to renovate pieces of it. We knew that we needed to take the carpet up and we needed to paint the interior and get it to be this kind of livable space. And once we received the money, we were able to expand on that. So we could do, it has two floors to it. We knew we could do the bottom level. Measure 110 helped us to be able to renovate the entire motel. So that was quite exciting for us. Also, what it helped us to do is our initial treatment model was that people would be in treatment out there with us for 90 days. We've been able to extend that people are now in treatment with us for 6 months.
And what kind of impact does that have, that longer treatment period?
Yes, because one of the things that I think people may not know, or some may, is that we're looking to change behavior as well as patterns, as well as environments, as well as ways of thinking and being. And it takes a little bit of time. So it's not only about living a drug-free life or sobriety and that, but rather how can we change people's cognitive thinking? How can we change people's patterns? How do we change their associations and mindsets? And so it takes a little bit of time for that. So what we're able to do is we have our program is an intensive outpatient treatment program. And for us, what that looks like, Althea, is that clients are with us for around 14 to 16 hours a week. And in 14 to 16 hours a week, five days a week, they have experiences that are, they're in group treatment and individual treatment. And so they're a part of our wellness program, which may look like them doing acupuncture and yoga and mindfulness. They also have psychoeducation, where they learn more about the impacts of drugs and chemicals on our body and our mind. They are also in substance use and mental health awareness groups. They are also experiencing, they meet with mentors who help them with life skills. And so with receiving all of these kinds of services, we're just hoping to kind of do our very best to help people with a variety of needs, but it takes a little bit of time. So keeping clients with us in an environment where they can constantly grow, that has a high level of support and accountability, and then where they can also develop a new community of friends and change behaviors in a safe space.
Mm-hmm. How have you seen your work, or more broadly, the work in your field, change as a result of Measure 110?
There have been several other culturally specific resource centers that have been funded and opened and have grown and flourished. And so that's been quite exciting, as well as with us. We're one of those organizations that have received funding and has been able to use the funding in a way that helps to support the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are there aspects of your work that you find are misunderstood?
I would say the amount of time that it takes to change behavior. I mean, sometimes people have thought, I would say, that you go into a clinic, you spend some time there, and then you come out on the other side and you are now living this drug-free life. It's work every day to make the right choices. It's work every day to do something different. So it requires creating a community. It requires changing habits. And so I would say that sometimes people may not know how much work is put into supporting people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where do you see Oregon Change Clinic growing from here?
Let's see. We are expanding our clinic. So right now we are doubling the size of our clinic because we have truly outgrown our current location. So we want to be able to help more people and we need more space. So we're doubling the size of the clinic in that way. We're also helping with long-term housing. So one of the challenge areas, Althea, has been that when people are in treatment and then, and we've extended it from 3 months to 6 months to give people more opportunity. And then from there, they graduate from our program, and long-term housing has been a challenge. Where do people live where they can still have ongoing support and accountability as needed? And so where we're growing is in that space. We're looking to have long-term housing for those who have completed our program but still continue to need some support.
Mm-hmm. What do you wish people knew about your work?
What I would like people to know is that because we are one of the few, and some will say the only, African-American, I mean, like, we are primarily, our clientele are primarily African-American men, actually, but we're the only African-American treatment facility here in the Portland metro area. And so for those who believe that this could be a right fit for them or someone that they know, I'd love for them to be able to contact us and see how we can help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, on that note, if listeners are interested in finding out more about Oregon Change Clinic or what we've talked about today, what's the best way for them to do that?
They can pull us up on the website. They can find us at OregonChangeClinic.com, and we're located in Portland, Oregon. And they can also call us. They can call us directly. They can call us at 503-719-7985, 503-719-7985, or they can go to our website.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
You know, I would say, Althea, although, you know, I'm in the work every day, I don't always think about it, but it's moments like this when I just kind of step out of the work and think about, just always hope that we're making a difference in the community that I grew up in and in my hometown here, and that if there's anyone out there that is needing services, I'm hoping that we could help.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me, Shannon. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate being here.
That was Shannon Jones-Isidore, CEO and founder of Oregon Change Clinic, providing treatment and temporary housing to BIPOC Portlanders. More information is online at OregonChangeClinic.com. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. Although it's been suggested in some circles that the power of white evangelicals is on the decline in the U.S., Some are saying that a movement known as the New Apostolic Reformation might have a major influence on the 2024 election. André Gagné is the chair of the Department of Theological Studies at Concordia University in Montreal, Canada. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg, who began by asking him if it was still true, as many commentators have said before, that right-wing evangelicals will vote for the most conservative candidate, regardless of whether they think that person is a good Christian.
Yes, exactly. I just came out with a book called American Evangelicals for Trump, Dominion, Spiritual Warfare, and the End Times. And it's about that, exactly. This, what we call or what we used to call the Christian right or the religious right in America that have been around for quite some time, since the 80s, the moral majority. But now we have a resurgence, at least since 2016, of these conservative Christians that decided to cast their ballot for Donald Trump. And you're absolutely right in saying that for them, it's about who Trump is, despite the fact that he is not necessarily in his actions. He doesn't necessarily reflect what would people understand to be necessarily Christian virtues per se. But in 2016, they voted for him at 81%. So 81% of white evangelicals voted for Trump. And when he went for re-election in 2020, the exit polls, the percentage of white evangelicals was between 76 and 81%. And of course he lost, but now he's on his road to returning in 2024. We'll see what happens. But they're still strongly behind him. And they vote for Trump because, you know, there's an idea behind their support of Trump. Many of them believe that God has chosen Trump in this moment to bring America back to God and bring America back to its Judeo-Christian foundations. And they see in Trump a kind of a strong man that will facilitate that for them. Because if you remember, during his first presidential mandate, he actually fulfilled his promises towards evangelicals. He appointed three conservative judges on the Supreme Court. He also appointed over 300 federal judges across the country that also were conservative.
Although a lot of that was done under Reagan and Bush.
Yeah, but he actually approved many of those during his own mandate because they were up for new appointments, new renewals, and he was pretty much involved in that. You remember also the famous move of the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. That was a major accomplishment, at least for evangelicals that have a particular view of the place of Israel in the end times before the return of Jesus Christ on earth to establish his kingdom. So for them, Trump is the one that's going to defend their values and respond to the grievances that they have been having for quite some time.
It's interesting on the Israel situation. Even Trump said at one point that he didn't think Netanyahu was really interested in peace. And he was kind of pissed off because of all he'd done for him.
Yeah, exactly. And it's quite incredible that even at the time when Trump was around, that Netanyahu had kind of embraced the rhetoric that was used towards Trump. A lot of evangelicals were saying that Trump was this kind of new Cyrus figure, this King Cyrus, the Persian king that is described in the Bible in Isaiah chapter 45, that Trump was a new Cyrus, a kind of new messianic figure. And Netanyahu used that same reference to describe Trump and saying, like, Trump is in the lineage of the great Cyrus, the Persian king. So it's interesting now, like what you say, everything that Trump has done for Netanyahu, his perspective on the situation now is interesting.
Are the people you're talking about, the evangelicals, would you say that this is part of the what they call the Christian identity movement, or is that really a sub-faction?
That would be a bit different than the Christian identity movement. Mm-hmm. In fact, in my book, I focus not on all evangelicals because we can, you know, the term evangelical is a very broad term to describe many different types of traditions. I focus more on the evangelicals that seem to be close to political power with Trump at the time, what I call neo-charismatic Pentecostal. They are a subset of evangelicals that focus more on their belief in what they call the gifts of the Spirit. Now, you find this in the New Testament. You find this in the Bible. It's this supernatural abilities that God would give Christians so that Christians would be empowered to build his church and proclaim the gospel message. Things like speaking in tongues, for example, healing, prophecy, miracles. So neo-charismatic Pentecostals embrace that. If you remember during the Trump years, there was this woman called Paula White Cain, who was Trump's spiritual advisor. And she is part of that kind of stream of evangelicals that we call neo-charismatic Pentecostals. If you remember, in many of the meetings that Trump attended, some political rallies, for example, the person that came on stage at first, even before Trump entered, was Paula White Cain. And often she engaged in prayer for Trump, for the presidency. So these are the kind of actors that I kind of explore in my book and try to help people understand who these people are, what they believe, and how are they motivated. What is their political theology? What is their sense of the involvement of Christians in the political arena in America?
And how do they get along with the other parts of the Republican coalition? You know, you have your traditional conservatives who just want to have lower taxes or and really don't care about guns and gays and school prayer and all that. And is there some kind of tension there?
Of course there is. A lot of them, they would label these people as rhinos, if you remember, right? Republicans in name only. Because for them, it's about the Judeo-Christian values. It's about bringing America back to God. They embrace a political theology of power that I describe in my book, which is called dominion theology. Essentially, dominion theology is this theocratic idea that Christians are called by God to exercise dominion in every aspect of society. And by doing so, in order to do so, in fact, they need to take control of cultural, social, and political institutions. So this is why for them being in politics, for example, is very, very important, because if they're in politics, they can influence policies and make sure that they align those policies to their beliefs or to their specific worldview. Now, this political theology that I unpack in my book, I try to explain that this is, of course, an idea. This is a theological idea that they read in the Bible. So when they read, for example, a specific text from the book of Genesis, one of the texts that deals with the creation story. In Genesis 1, chapter 1, verses 26 to 28, God mandates humankind to exercise dominion over creation.
But it's not domination.
That's it. It's not domination over other individuals. It's how you manage creation. But they take that for themselves. They say, oh, this dominion mandate is for Christians. Christians are to exercise authority. So you see,
nothing
so this
ecumenical
is,
there.
It's not much ecumenism. And there's not much of a ecumenical spirit there, for sure. But you know, this is a political idea. Like, this is kind of their political philosophy or political theology. But the thing is, that's very abstract. How do you get there, like, from this idea to concrete action? They came up eventually, and this has been reported often in the media. You hear that sometimes. You hear this idea of the Seven Mountain Mandate, which is a kind of a marketing mobilization strategy that was popularized by this Christian entrepreneur by the name of Lance Wallnau, who wrote a book on Trump in 2016 called God's Chaos Candidate. So Wallnau didn't invent this concept, but he popularized. It's this idea that society is represented through various spheres of culture. Like, for example, they represent this as mountains. Like the mountain of government or business or education or the family or media, arts and entertainment and religion. And for them, Christians need to occupy the high places of those cultural spheres in order to influence and change the culture of those spheres. So when you do that, when you're at the top echelons of those spheres, you will bring about dominion. You will bring about what they call the kingdom of God on earth. So essentially, that's their political strategy. And Trump is a tool to get there, you see, to make that happen, because he listens to them. You see, Trump and them had this kind of transactional relationship during his mandate. Like, he listened to their grievances and he tried to meet and satisfy his promises towards them, but he relied on their support, on their voting support. So that's how it works. And people that are in their way, people that don't agree with that kind of mandate, are often sidetracked or sidelined, or they are delegitimized as political adversaries, where they start using language of spiritual warfare, demonizing political adversaries and enemies as being influenced under the powers of evil forces. So that's how it plays out. It's a kind of rhetorical strategy to polarize people and force people to choose.
That was Concordia University professor Andre Gagne speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, everybody, it's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents. Glad you're listening. This is KBOO 90.7, Portland.
Tune in to KBOO throughout February, every Tuesday at 7 p.m. for Black History Future Month, our special